Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thanks for joining me today on It's All About Food. How are you doing? It's February 3rd, 2015, and it's cold here. It's 25 degrees, actually, in New York City. And you know what always amazes me is when it gets colder, like in the teens, and then it, quote, warms up to 25 or 35, all of a sudden it feels balmy and comfortable. These lower temperatures are more manageable after we've gotten some horrible chill from really, really cold weather. Anyway, I like the change. I like the weather. I like the cold. It's really important to have the right gear, the right wear, so that you don't hurt yourself in the cold, because we're really not meant to be out in such cold weather. All right, let's get moving here. There's a lot to talk about today, and I want to bring on my first guest, Ted Genoese. He's the author of The Chain, Farm, Factory, and Fate of Our Food. He served as editor of the Virginia Quarterly Review from 2003 to 2012, and he's the contributing editor at Mother Jones and editor-at-large at On Earth, and his essays and poetry have appeared in The Atlantic, Bloomberg, Businessweek, Harper's, The New Republic, Outside, and The Washington Post, Book World. He is the winner of the James Arison Award for Social Justice Journalism and the recipient of fellowships from the NEA and the Guggenheim Foundation. And he lives in Lincoln, Nebraska. Ted, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Is it cold in Nebraska?
It's cold and snow-covered, but I guess you kind of expect it if you live on the Great Plains.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be talking a lot more about Nebraska in the next half hour and some other states. And I think you've written a very important book, The Chain, Farm, Factory, and Fate of Our Food. And I'm sure a lot of people have told you this, that they didn't enjoy reading it, but are glad they did.
It's not always an easy read, and it wasn't always pleasant writing the book, but the more I researched it, the more I became convinced that it was, you know, a story that needed to be told.
It needs to be told, and we need to hear it every day, and we're not.
True enough. So I appreciate having the time to talk to you about it.
Yeah. So if we have the chance, we're going to touch on a number of subjects, including immigrants, factory inspections, illness from working in slaughterhouses, how the insurance companies respond, antibiotics in animal foods, corn, growing corn, and how we should be growing our food, and politicians who are supposed to be supporting good causes and our needs, vertical integration. You touch on so many different subjects in this book, and there's like problems with everything.
Yes, well, I mean, that was really the idea behind the approach and the reason for the title of The Chain. I mean, it's a kind of play on words, that there's both the conveyor system within the meatpacking plants that sets the speed of production, but there's also the supply chain, and that, to my mind, if you're going to look at the speed of the chain, the physical chain within the plant, you have to look at what the impact of that increase of speed of production, what effect it's having up and down the supply chain, often in places that are invisible to the consumer.
So I was pretty sick to my stomach most of the time while reading this book. But I just pressed on. Well, you know, I very often it's hard for me to understand how my fellow humans can do some of the things that they do. And very often I say to myself, well, they don't really understand, or they don't really know. And many times in the book I felt like, yeah, they know what they're doing. And it's evil.
Yeah, well, I mean, you touched on the idea of vertical integration. I mean, one of the things that makes the chain possible, the full supply chain possible, is this vertical integration that exists, that allows large meatpacking companies to own and have a financial interest in everything from the feed in the fields to the final product that goes out to the grocery counter. And what that does is mean that there's a very small group of people who are making the decisions about how things are going to be run. And their decisions have almost nothing to do with worker safety, with food safety, with environmental safety, animal welfare, the decisions are entirely made based on the bottom line. And when they make the decision that certain input costs have to be kept below a certain point, they make that decision in a boardroom, and that decision is passed down through the company all the way to the ground level. And in order to make those things a reality, it often means cutting corners. It means asking people to do more work than they're capable of doing. And in those circumstances, people do start to make bad decisions, and they do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do. And that's why, to me, the thing that's always most frustrating is that when there are instances of things like animal abuse or worker abuse, very often those investigations stop at the level of whoever was directly involved in those incidents, rather than moving up the chain and saying, you know, who made the decisions that created the conditions for those circumstances to emerge?
Oh, of course, it's always best to blame the little guy, not the person
right.
making the decision and paying your salary. Oh, it's evil. So what we're talking about for the most part in this book is raising pigs for their meat and other products. And it's just so frustrating to read how often history has repeated itself. So I remember in elementary school, I'm not a farmer, and I read about farming, but I don't know much about it. But there are things that stuck in my mind when I was a kid. And one of them was how farmers had to rotate their fields. They needed to let a field rest and nourish it so that the life can rejuvenate and it'll be ready in a year or whenever to grow more food. And there were all kinds of safeguards that we had learned over time from lots of mistakes. The government had even made some regulations to farm sustainably. And then everything went wrong. It's like we forgot everything. And it's all about farming on every little inch of your property, never resting anything, using the most chemicals you possibly can, getting rid of all the beneficial insects and native plants that help protect the land and keep it alive. It's just overwhelming.
It's all true. And you know, my grandfather, my dad's dad, was a farmer and worked on a farm for most of the time that my dad was growing up. And so my dad grew up on those farms. And when he was a kid in the 1940s and 50s, it was exactly as you described. The farms were diversified. The crops were rotated. And there was lots of emphasis on sort of manual labor methods of pest control and weed control. That all changed dramatically in the 1970s when, first of all, the USDA decided that they would use the corn reserves that the country had built up as a foreign policy strategic tool to drop grain prices and to make the world dependent on American grain. And at the same time, the decision was made that we could supply the world by industrializing agriculture, by turning toward chemical pesticides and herbicides and fungicides. And as you say, it was from that point forward that everything began to focus on specializing and maximizing. And rather than having all of the tools that we had at our disposal for sustainable farming and all the lessons that we had learned during the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl era, and the period of overplanting that had created the Dust Bowl, we've moved right back into that same sort of mentality. What Earl Butz, who was the head of the USDA at the time of all this change, referred to as fence row to fence row, that you know, if you've got any available inch of land, that you should be planting on it so that there's greater production, greater profit.
All right. Right now, we have a devastating situation, and you talk about so much of it in the book, how the water quality in many of these areas that are close to these confined animal feedlots, these CAFOs, the water is polluted and people are getting sick, and they make requests and demands to the government agency and nobody does anything. There are regulations that nobody follows. Companies are fined. Nobody pays the fine. Everybody's ignoring everything. It's very, very depressing. And I'm wondering, are we going to have something like a Dust Bowl again? Only it won't be a Dust Bowl. Maybe it'll be a Desert Bowl, or there'll be no more water, or people won't
I think that the first place to look at right now as a cautionary tale is what's happening in West Texas. West Texas, which has been dependent always on the High Plains aquifer system, has essentially drained that aquifer, and they've drained it in the name of raising feed corn for the cattle industry, and there's simply not enough water to sustain either the crops or the livestock themselves now, and you're seeing the closure of feedlots and then consequently the closure of packing houses because there's just not enough water to keep the cattle alive. And the sort of compounded problem is something that's called dust pneumonia, which comes from the ground getting so dry and so much dust being kicked up into the air that the cattle inhale it and it causes pneumonia. So there are places that are starting to move operations out of Texas because there's just simply not enough water to sustain the beef industry there. Iowa has a problem that's sort of in the opposite direction. There's plenty of water that's available, but what they've done is not managed the water such that it's now heavily, heavily contaminated by nitrates and by E. coli and other coliform bacteria. And it's become so extreme a problem, especially because of the hog industry in Iowa, that the Des Moines Water Works has actually just recently sued several of the northwest counties in Iowa in order to keep them from dumping so much waste into the water upstream that the city is no longer able to reliably keep itself in compliance with the Clean Water Act. So I do think that we're reaching a kind of crisis point with the way that that conventional agriculture is being carried out in the country right now. With always pushing everything to its absolute limit, there is, of course, eventually a breaking point. And I think that in several places we seem to be at that point now.
Stay tuned to the breaking point. I'm not looking forward to that, but hopefully we'll be able to move on to something better. Now, in your book, in the beginning, you talk a lot about immigrants, some of them who come to the United States legally, some illegally, and the whole scenario about hiring immigrants at these packing houses, these slaughterhouses, these meat factories, and there are so many pieces of the chain there that are heartbreaking, speeding up the lines to make more meat, and it's dangerous. These people get injuries, they lose fingers, they get arms crushed, they get all kinds of diseases. Nobody wants to take care of them or pay for them. The neighborhood doesn't like them anymore because they're getting all the jobs, but they're only getting the jobs because the neighborhood kind of allowed things to happen over time that encouraged this sort of activity. It's a mess, and nobody really has a clear picture about how to solve it.
I think that's really true. I mean, the problem by now has evolved over a period of more than three decades. I mean, with Hormel Foods, this goes back to the strike that occurred in the mid-'80s when the company attempted to slash worker wages and cut benefits. And after the strike was finally resolved, and essentially the unions lost out entirely, the only concession that they had really secured was a promise from Hormel that when the positions in the plant that had been occupied by strike breakers reopened, when people left those positions, that preferential hiring would be offered to the workers who had worked there before, the union members. Instead, as soon as that agreement was struck, Hormel announced that the cut and kill side of their operation, the slaughter side of their operation, was now a separate company.
I couldn't believe reading that story.
Absolutely, and they're a separate company and they don't have a contract with the union, and in fact, they don't pay as well as Hormel, and so, as you might imagine, many of the workers, the former workers, first of all, you know, felt that they had been utterly betrayed, and they had, but they also refused to work for the lower wages. And what Hormel did was fill those positions with immigrant labor, a lot of it undocumented immigrant labor. And as you said, the advantage from their standpoint was that they now had a workforce that was not going to be active in the union, so that strikes were no longer likely. They were not likely to complain about work conditions, and if they were injured and wanted to file work compensation claims, the company was in a position at that point to question their immigration status, and many of the workers, when that would occur, would simply flee rather than face deportation, which would get the company off the hook from having to pay for those injuries.
Yeah.
And it's such an entrenched system now. You know, it's not just Hormel. It's many of the large meatpacking firms that rely on immigrant labor, that it is hard to see how the whole trend would be reversed. But I do think it's important to bear in mind that it hasn't always been this way, and so there's no need for this to be accepted simply as the status quo and the sort of permanent state of things. You know, this is a problem that can be fixed, and I hope that there will eventually be some immigration reform that allows some of the workers to have greater say in their conditions, their work conditions, and I would hope also that there is greater government oversight, so that there is someone who is paying attention to the way that workers are treated inside the plant.
There's a lot of hoping there.
Yes, there is. I mean, but if you don't hope for things to get better, they only get worse. I mean, they rarely improve on their own.
I was just feeling so bad for everyone, the people who were the, quote, locals in the community. You know, nobody's ever local. There's always some other group of people who came before us. And when you mentioned the promises that Hormel made to its people, it just reminded me of the promises the pilgrims made to the Indians that we didn't keep very well. We don't have a good record of keeping promises in this country. But the people that were fighting against the immigrants in their neighborhoods for taking jobs and making them pay taxes to cover the immigrants' costs and whatever, they just didn't realize that they were all a piece of a chain and that the immigrants weren't the bad party. The bad party were the big companies, the big corporations that brought them in to exploit them.
Well, and this is the thing with these company towns. I mean, it's a trend that's been going on since World War II, that meatpacking companies have tended to build new plants in small towns that are along highways and railroad lines, where they have ready access to the market, but they don't have a workforce that is as connected into union leadership and into larger labor movements. And so what you get are workforces that are isolated and are more easily exploited. And what this means is that in these company towns, the workers who are the previous generation of workers, many of whom have been displaced by immigrant labor. As I said, they feel betrayed, but they're also kind of trapped. The, the companies are very often, these plants are the major employer in town. They may be, you know, critical to the tax base. They're, you know, very often tied into public utilities projects, and the town is in many ways utterly dependent on them. So when they're angry at a company like Hormel, instead of directing that anger directly at the company and enraging the company in a way that might potentially drive them out of town, they tend to turn their anger on the workforce. And as you say, it's a terrible outcome, because the people who are already exploited are then also facing community outrage and are kind of driven underground in ways that makes it so that it's very difficult for them to advocate on their own behalf.
Now, the products that are coming out of the areas that you've covered, we have Hormel, they're the makers of Spam, but they're also makers of higher-end pork products. There were other companies, and more they're starting to export some of their meat to countries like Japan and China.
Yes, that's right.
Here's a question just for you, Ted. Do you eat any of the products from these companies?
I do not. I don't for a number of reasons.
That's going to lead to another question, but yeah, continue.
I would prefer, if I'm going to be spending money on meat products, to be giving my money to as directly as possible to the growers who raised the in this case the hogs, and to know how the animal was slaughtered, how it was butchered. I want to be involved in that process if at all possible. But I also just don't want to be giving my money to a company that is exploiting its labor force and isn't concerned with animal welfare and has a poor environmental track record. And as you say, in the case of this book, that's Hormel Foods that I'm looking at, but you could look at almost any of the major meat packers and find similar problems.
So you do eat meat?
I do eat meat. Yes, I do. Now, I'm fortunate to be in a place like Nebraska where there are lots of local producers around, and I am able to not only see the animals while they're still on the hoof, but get to know my farmers and have good relationships with them so that I know exactly what their practices are. But I think not only for people in rural areas like where I am, but I think across the country it's getting easier to get access to food that is sustainably produced. And I think also the consumers are starting to realize that the price differential between the sort of industrially produced meat and sustainably produced meat is not that wide. And that especially when you start to factor in other social costs and environmental costs for your community, I think it becomes an easy investment to say that you're willing to spend a little bit more at the grocery store if it means that the animals are better treated, that the farmer is better treated, and that the community and environment are treated better.
As you may know, I am a very out vegan.
Yep.
And good. Surprise. And although, you know, I would love people not to kill animals for any reason at all, it certainly would be better if we didn't have factory farms and have animals confined in these horrific conditions that are filthy and unhealthy and terrible to humans as well as to the animals.
Right.
The catch, though, is everybody has to eat a lot less meat in order to raise animals in this the way that you describe, which you consider sustainable. I mean, we cannot grow the quantity of animals to make the meat products that people are consuming today without confining them in this horrific way.
That's absolutely true. And I think that, that's the thing that for people who are intending to continue to eat meat, at the very least, you know, we have to start to make peace with the idea that, we can't consume meat at every meal, that we can't consume the quantity of meat that is often on offer at restaurants in America, that all of this is just not sustainable, especially as our population continues to grow. And so to me, the trade-off is saying, well, I'm going to choose higher quality meat that is produced in a way that I feel is more ethical, and I will be willing to deal with, smaller portions of that. But I also have to say, as a meat eater, I find that if you can consume something with a bit more of a clear conscience and you've got something that's higher quality, it is more satisfying than just large quantities of something that you're trying not to think of where it came from.
I can understand that. I can spin that over to when I'm consuming a dessert that is a very small portion. It's made with high quality ingredients. I don't need pounds and pounds of it if I have like a few morsels of a very rich, satisfying treat. I do want to say, and you may not agree with me, probably not, but I believe that this ability to exploit humanity, you mentioned before exploiting the labor force, I think it starts, for me, I think when you believe it's okay to kill another sentient being for food or for whatever reason, that starts the numbing process and then enables you to accept other forms of exploitation. So that enabled us to treat the animals worse and worse because we needed to make more money and profit more. And then that enables us to exploit humans, our fellow humans as well. And it, but I think the numbing process, that ability to exploit, starts from a fundamental concept.
I think that's fair. I mean, I don't think there's any way around the fact that when one decides to consume meat, that what you're doing is killing a living animal so that you can consume it. And what so much of the industrial process is about is removing that whole grisly reality from view. And that's why I, you know, I think that if one is going to eat meat, that you have to be more aware of the process. I mean, I, like I said, I not only know the farmers, I see the animals on the hoof, I've participated in the slaughter and butchering of the animals, and I do that because I think, you know, if I don't have the stomach to be involved in the process, then I shouldn't be doing this at all. And I think at the very least, it makes me much more conscious of what I'm eating and much more judicious about the consumption of that meat as well. And I think exactly as you say, that as soon as you start to distance yourself from those realities, then it becomes easier to objectify and distance yourself from the workers, from the farmers, from everybody who's involved in the process. And that's unquestionably bad for everyone.
Okay, we just have a few more minutes. Any recommendations you can make to all of us about how we can solve some of these problems?
Well, one thing that I can say that I think is a is an exciting development of the last few days is that an organization called the Food Integrity Campaign, that, which is part of the Government Accountability Project, has taken up the sort of cause of trying to urge Hormel Foods to slow its production lines. And if listeners just go to foodwhistleblower.org, they will find that there is information there about this campaign and about the, petition that is being circulated and that they hope to deliver to the CEO of Hormel Foods. And I think that that though this may be largely a symbolic move, that it is useful to let some of these companies know that the word is getting out and that people are concerned about the way that the workers are treated inside these plants, the way that that food safety is handled in these plants and the way that, that the environment is being affected. And so simply by adding your name to that list, I think it does help send that message.
A couple more things. I could talk to you for a long time. There are so many issues here that matter. This whole whistleblower concept, you know, we had regulation that was created about a decade or so ago, this Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act that's just a nightmare and puts a lot of fear in a lot of activists to speak up and be a whistleblower.
It certainly does, and I'm pleased to say that, some of the Government Accountability Project, they were some of the people who were involved in defending some of those ag gag whistleblowers, and I think it was really through those efforts that a group of USDA inspectors from Hormel Foods have now come forward, and their descriptions of the treatment of animals and of the food safety practices inside these plants have now been added to the growing chorus of voices talking about the problems in these plants. And my hope is that that this is kind of finally the piece that's been needed for the USDA to say we have to address this. At the point that the USDA's own inspectors say this isn't right, this isn't safe, I would hope that at that point they have to address it.
Right. Well, I would hope to. Also, I'm just looking at this article that came out in the New York Times a little over a week ago about the U.S. Meat Animal Research Center.
Right.
And, I mean, that's another scary bit of information about how tax money is being used to do horrific experiments on animals in Nebraska.
That's correct. That's just across town from me. And so, yeah, it's very true, and I think it goes back to your earlier point that when we get too disconnected from the farm, too disconnected from the animals themselves, it becomes easy to make decisions about the way that research is conducted, about the way that animals are raised, the way that they are slaughtered. Because you're not seeing the actual consequences. And I think that if the companies themselves are not willing to take a hard look at their practices, then it's really, really required of our leaders in the government to establish common sense guidelines that protect everyone.
That sounds good. Stay tuned to see what really happens next in the real world of us.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ted. Thanks for writing The Chain, Farm Factory, and the Fate of Our Food. And I've had a real pleasure talking with you today.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Okay, take care. All right, it's time for a break. And when we come back, we're going to lighten it up a little bit and talk about the best green smoothies on the planet with Tracy Russell. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody. I'm back. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food on the 3rd of February, 2015. Let's lighten it up a little bit, shall we? Good. All right, I'm going to bring on my next guest, Tracy Russell. She has tried just about every fad diet and expensive superfood supplement out there. It wasn't until she discovered the green smoothie that she lost 40 pounds, lowered her cholesterol by 50 points, and started running marathons. She's one of the foremost experts on green smoothies and nutrition and shares her wealth of firsthand information, research, experiences with tens of thousands of people every day. She's the author of one of the largest green smoothie websites on the internet, IncredibleSmoothies.com, which she launched in 2009 to help others achieve a healthy lifestyle. Welcome to It's All About Food, Tracy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I'm really good. So we just had a very heavy first part of the program, talking about the horrors of factory farming and all that it does to the planet and to people and to animals. And now I want to sit back and relax and just imagine delicious green smoothies.
I had the pleasure of listening to some of it. Yeah, green smoothies are definitely, they changed my life. Like you said, I tried a lot of different things to be healthy out there, and so it wasn't until my sister-in-law actually introduced me to green smoothies that it just changed my life. You know, food can definitely be a good thing or it can be a bad thing for you. And, you know, it was amazing how just mixing things together can, and drinking it, and it was delicious. And you know, I noticed the weight kind of started coming off, and then it wasn't until probably about 4 months after drinking green smoothies, I tested my cholesterol, and I was surprised that it had gone down significantly. You know, I have a family history of high cholesterol, so I was really happy to see that.
And we like happy stories here. We like happy stories very much. We need more of them, and your sharing this information will help make more people happy and healthy. So that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my book, The Best Green Smoothies on the Planet, just came out in December, actually, and it has a lot of my favorite recipes in it. A lot of these recipes are smaller recipes than I usually make, because for me personally, I make a large green smoothie that's about 32 ounces. So the recipes in the book, they're for more of the beginner person, kind of getting used to drinking green smoothies. And so I talk a lot about, you know, why green smoothies, the health benefits, you know, a little bit of benefit about each fruit and what to add. And, you know, adding different things to your smoothie can definitely target different health goals that you have. So, you know, adding apples are going to help you lose weight, chia seeds because they're more high in fiber, adding things like oats, cashews, seeds like hemp seeds, chia seeds, flax seeds. Those are high in protein, so they're good for, you know, if you're active and you're working out, and, you know, you can get calcium from your green smoothies with, you know, dark leafy greens or with sesame seeds. You can also add almond milk. It's a great source of calcium. So depending on what your health needs are, you know, you can get a really good boost of nutrients from your green smoothie, and they're just full of energy. I was surprised, like you mentioned, I actually ran the Chicago Marathon. It was something that I never thought I would ever be able to do, but it was one of those dreams in the back of my mind. I was like, I want to run a marathon someday. So I was like, nah, I'll never actually do it. And then I just had this opportunity, and I was surprised when I actually started running. I tried running back before green smoothies, and I could not even run a mile. It was awful. I was so embarrassed, but after I joined a running group when I was probably drinking green smoothies for about a year, and I was running, I'm about to say, wasn't running a marathon my first drink, but, you know, I was running very fast for someone who was new. And so, you know, I did it, and I was really proud. I was actually kind of overwhelmed with emotion as I started running the very first, you know, I ran probably half a block, and I kind of got emotional. I was like, wow, I can't believe I'm actually doing this. And
I can do this. Yes.
Yeah. It was great. And, you know, people always talking to me about how I have such, you know, glowing skin. And I actually gave up my coffee, my morning coffee, because I just, I had so much energy. And a really funny story. I had someone on my website, Facebook, incrediblesmoothies.com, the Facebook page. She actually commented. She said, this is a side effect from green smoothies. She said, I made a smoothie, and I had so much energy. I cleaned out my refrigerator. I couldn't believe it. I was just so much energy. I kind of laughed. I was like, yeah, that's a wonderful side effect of green smoothies. And
yeah,
so,
that's
like
funny.
I gave up the coffee. So did my husband. We both, you know, we have a little child. Our son is about a year and a half. And, you know, even with the energy that he has, we keep up with him, and we give him green smoothies, and we've been starting him on green smoothies. Probably
now that could be dangerous. Giving young kids green smoothies, they'll have even more energy than they normally have.
I made that mistake. We usually give him a smoothie for breakfast, and I made that mistake the other day. I gave him a smoothie for dinner, and his nap time, his bedtime is about 8 o'clock, and my husband and I at 9 o'clock were like, "What's going on?" And I'm like, "No, that's right. I gave him a smoothie for dinner." But it's a good thing. It's, you know, I feel a lot better giving him, you know, a green smoothie as opposed to a lot of processed food, because, you know, and I don't mix, like, a lot of people ask me about baby smoothies or smoothies, not for babies, for small children, but for my son, I've been giving them to him since he was so little, that I give him smoothies with dandelion greens, smoothies with kale. I don't use a lot, but just a little bit. And so when you get your kids on smoothies very early, you can actually mix, you know, you can mix what you would mix for yourself and just give them to them, you know.
It seems like a natural for children, because we feed children, quote, baby food. I'm not sure when baby food was discovered, but puree of different fruits and vegetables, and that's really all a smoothie is, although smoothies tend to be more raw than cooked, like we get
in
baby food.
So it is, it is something I'd recommend. If you're going to start your child on smoothies, I would wait till they're about 6 months after they've had puree, and obviously you want to make sure they've had the ingredients in the smoothie. You know, you can try one new ingredient, but other than that, I would make sure they had everything in it. So I gave him, his first smoothie was papaya, banana, and kale, and he loved it. He drank it. I was surprised when I first gave it to him. I was like, oh, let's try it. And he loved it. I actually conned him into eating a piece of spinach, because I just took when we make smoothies, we, you know, put a little this and a little that, and we eat a little this, eat a little that, and so my husband and I were making a smoothie with spinach, and I just took a piece, and I was like, ooh, this is yummy. And so he took a piece and put it in his mouth, and, you know, in a year and a half, he was eating raw spinach. So it's definitely something that, you know, helps kids, gets their nutrients in them, and, you know, it's definitely a good thing for everybody all around. And like I said, you know, it's a great way to get target nutrients if you're looking for certain things like calcium or iron. You can just find certain foods that have the nutrients that you're looking for, and then you can make, you know, smoothies with those ingredients.
You know, there's all different kinds of history all over the world of the food that people eat, and we're just starting really to learn about nutrition with science. Mm-hmm. People will talk like they know a lot about nutrition, and most people really don't, because we're really just discovering things. But right now, the current science promotes a plant-based diet, lots of whole, minimally processed, fresh fruits and vegetables. And for some people, that's really alien, because their culture or through history, they just haven't been eating that way. And now with highly processed foods and junk foods and convenience foods, people don't know how to eat fruits and vegetables. Mm-hmm. And I agree that a smoothie is a great way to reintroduce people to what they should be eating, in a way that's easy to go down.
Yeah, I'm definitely not a salad eater, which is surprising, because I'm in the nutrition field, and most people would be shocked that I don't like salads. But a lot of it is the fatty dressings you put on it, or just other stuff and it's just not appealing to me to eat lettuce. But I eat in smoothies. I eat dandelion greens. Kale is one of my favorite greens. You know, bok choy, a green I would never think to eat. And, you know, I put beet greens, carrot greens, any kind of greens, just put them in your smoothie. And
now I'm wondering, and I don't know if you know this, do you know the history behind smoothies, when they were first discovered?
When they were first discovered, I don't know. I know Victoria Batenko sort of popularized it back, I think it was in the 80s, kind of brought it more to the modern world. But I know that some people have said, some people that are, I don't want to say how old they are, but older, have said, you know, I was drinking smoothies, but we didn't have a name for it back in the 70s. So
some people call them blended salads.
Yeah, they've been around for a very long time. They just haven't been as mainstream. I think
maybe with the invention of a blender.
Yeah, I think just recently they've become more and more popular, because it's a convenient thing. For me, I don't like cooking, and that was one of the big things that got me into green smoothies. I make a smoothie for breakfast, I make a smoothie for lunch, but you can make them in advance. Like, you can make them, they can sit in your refrigerator up to 48 hours. Mm. And so you can make them, if you have a busy schedule, you can make one for everyone in your family, put it in the refrigerator the night before, and then when everyone wakes up in the morning, you're just like, okay, here's your smoothie. You have to shake it a little bit. But give everyone their smoothie, they drink them, you know, throw the glass on the side, and then you're ready to go. And you can have another one for lunch, or you can have one for lunch and not for breakfast. But they're just so easy and convenient.
You know, you mentioned in your book, I've got a big fear against plastic these days, and I use a lot of glass and stainless. And when I'm traveling, I store water or other drinks in glass bottles that has like a rubber handle on the outside, so if it falls, it doesn't break, those kinds of things. But one thing I haven't thought about is a glass straw, and I'm going to get a few of those.
Now, I love my glass straws. I actually have a lot of glass straws by Glass Dharma, and they have these wonderful straws that have little beads on them. I hold them for my son, but it helps him know how far to put the straw in his mouth, because he'll put it in, but then when he gets to the bead, he won't put the bead over his mouth. Mm. And so it's great, and it's a great little tip. Also, he has to hold it because it's a glass and he's only a year and a half, but it's, you know, he does really well with it, and they're decorative. They have some other straws, but yeah, glass straws are great. And, I know Glass Dharma, they're actually very durable. I've had mine for probably about 3 years now, about six of them. Mm-hmm. I did drop one once and it did break, but that was my fault. I dropped it on like a cement floor on the wrong, but they replaced it. So it was great. But you know, yeah, we use the mason jars and you can get some lids for those that have holes on them or holes in the top, and then you just put the straw in it, and it's great.
And you mentioned a lot of very helpful tips in the book, and a few I want to highlight. And so to make a smoothie or a blended salad, basically you need some liquid, you need some fruits, you need some greens, maybe some other mm-hmm. items that you can add to it. But a lot of times if we go to a store or a place that makes smoothies, they may not put the same good ingredients in that you're going to get when you're at home. A lot of times they use juice or other mm-hmm. overly sweetened, sugarly processed stuff.
Yeah, that's just one of the issues
which
that people have.
Which gives smoothies a bad name.
Yes, it does. That is, I know a few of the places. I won't really go get smoothies when I'm out. I mean, some places actually do. Most of the time, you can't get a green smoothie unless you're actually at a juice bar. Most of the time, if you're going to, I won't say the name of it, but it's a popular juice place, mm-hmm. you're going to get your fruit and a lot of ice in it. They've used fruit juices or, you know, sweet ingredients, but I actually prefer to sweeten my smoothies with a banana. I find that it helps sweeten it enough.
And it makes it creamy and gives it a nice mm-hmm. thickness.
Yeah, and you can use frozen bananas for more of like that ice cream yogurt kind of consistency. But I find, as far as when you're talking about actually making smoothies at home, I know a lot of people have a hard time with the greens and stuff like that. And there actually is kind of a little bit of a science to adding all the ingredients to your blender to help them blend better. And it's, you know, adding your water first, and then you add your soft fruits, like your banana. If you're going to add any sort of, you know, berries, you add the soft fruit first, then you add your harder fruits or your vegetables, and then your greens. And then if you're going to have any ice, you put that on top. And then when you blend it, it helps push everything down. So the soft fruit and the liquid help create a vortex to pull everything down. It kind of helps blend everything a little bit better so you don't get as much junk in your smoothie.
Now, you said you don't like eating salads.
No.
And that's okay. But did eating these green foods and these smoothies and introducing more plant foods into your diet, did that expand your menu for other foods outside of smoothies? Obviously, you had to be giving up something in order to lose the weight and drop the cholesterol. So
yeah,
what else changed?
I actually eat, my diet is very different from what it used to be. And that's the thing about having green smoothies is you find they're not as, you know, because, I mean, they're technically a processed food because they are blended, but they don't have that processed food flavor. So you can get, you know, you really taste the banana, you taste, you know, the apple. It's not apple flavoring, it's an apple. And your taste buds change and start to shift. And so I gave up a lot of processed food, you know, cheese, I gave up dairy, I gave up meat, I gave up, you know, most packaged things. I used to eat a lot of those 100-calorie snacks. They were only 100 calories,
mm-hmm.
and I gave those things up. And pretty much anything that said diet, low fat, you know, eat me because I'm good for you, anything that had to tell you it was good for you, pretty much gave it up. And that's, you know, kind of effortlessly felt, you know, the weight started falling off. For dinner, I stick to a lot of quinoa, brown rice. So, you know, I definitely changed how I eat. And I did go, I did eat a raw food diet for a while, but then I sort of came back to, I liked cooked food, so I started going back to cooked food. But it was definitely an eye-opener. You know, I have a Vitamix, and you can make so much in the Vitamix. You can make your own hummus. You can make your own nut butter and make this delicious raw ice cream mm-hmm. with frozen bananas. And you can use two frozen bananas as your base, and then you use a cup of whatever frozen fruit you want. So you can use cherries and then a little bit of almond milk just to make it creamy, a little splash of vanilla, and it is delicious. Mm-hmm. So I make that all summer long, and I even share it with my son, and it's a great, great snack, and, you know, I don't feel guilty.
Oh, gosh, I'm thinking of that horrible ice cream commercial that I've seen on television where the parents don't want to share their ice cream with their son, which is just a horrifying image to begin with, but I'm glad to hear that you share with your son.
Oh, and my son, he eats everything I eat. So it's funny because literally if I have food, he's like, oh, what are we eating? And, you know, he gets pretty much a last bite of everything I eat. So it's a great diet, you know. And he loves our green smoothies. Like, he gets so excited when the blender goes on and we turn it on, and he'll just laugh and he'll point to it and he'll go vroom, vroom. So
well, you probably know that the best way to get children to eat better is to set an example by eating good yourself.
Yeah, it is.
And to have the right foods available mm-hmm. and not have the wrong foods in the house.
Yeah, that's correct. It's definitely good having, you know, he sees us drinking the green smoothies. And even if he's had something for breakfast, because when we get up in the morning, getting him ready and getting ourselves, my husband and I, getting ready for work, you know, sometimes he will eat something before we get up. And when we get up and make our smoothies, he's like, I want the smoothie. You know, give me some of Mom's, give me some of Dad's. And, you know, he loves them.
Now, in your book, you've got hundreds and hundreds of different recipes, and you use all kinds of fruits. Some of them are pretty average mainstream that anyone in the United States can find in most supermarkets. And then there are some that are more exotic, more mm-hmm. tropical, and for some people might be harder to find or not. But the point is that there's the plant kingdom is huge. There's a lot of variety, and mm-hmm. it never has to be boring.
Right. That's one thing I tell a lot of people, because they'll look at my recipes and they'll say, oh, I can't find this. Can I use this? And, or especially greens. Greens are the big thing if you're not in the United States. You know, if I'm using something like bok choy, or even if I'm using collard greens, people ask, where can I get that green? And, you know, I tell people, use the greens that's readily available to you, because that's the most nutritious, and you can use whatever, you know, I'm not in where you are, so, you know, find the greens that are available to you. And there's just a huge variety, like you said, a variety of greens and fruits and even seeds that you can add to your smoothies. And, you know, I try and keep them fairly simple so that the average person can go to the store and pick them up. But sometimes that does get a little bit, I don't want to say boring, but you get used to the same thing. So sometimes I like to add, you know, some goji berries or something that is a little more exotic for some people.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, we get in routines, and sometimes routines are good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know my husband usually makes the same smoothie over and over again. He doesn't really have much of a routine, other than he rotates his greens a little bit. But
well,
you know,
as long as he gets his greens and he's happy with it, that works.
That's what's important.
Right. Yeah. Well, Tracy, really nice talking to you, and I'm feeling so much better now that we've talked about my favorite food, leafy green vegetables.
mm-hmm.
I know there's hope for the planet.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, it was nice talking to you.
Yes, and take care.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. That was Tracy Russell, and you can visit her website, Incredible Smoothies, incrediblesmoothies.com. Well, we just have like another minute, and I wanted to mention, I think I mentioned it the last time, we started a new web series at responsibleeatingandliving.com, and if you haven't seen it yet, you can see the first one. We're about to put up our second one. It's called Real Good News in Review. We have a brief newscast. We go into the transition kitchen and make some great transition foods for people who are moving from the animal to the plant. And then we feature a local business who's doing some great things and either providing a service or making a product that is in line with our mission at Responsible Eating and Living. So I hope you check that out. Please share it, like it, and other than that, have a delicious week. Bye-bye.